everyone.
Woo!
We're into week four on our series in Revelation. It's interesting, some of the great interactions we've had over the last couple of weeks in regards to some of the things we hear on Sunday morning, some of the things we've engaged with on Sunday night in particular as well, and some of the questions that have come out of all of that. Questions like, what is the gospel? Or other questions that have come up, you know, why isn't the church growing in a place like Aotearoa? Why aren't we growing? Why do the numbers seem to be going in the opposite direction? What are we doing wrong? And all these things that come up, which is really interesting. And some of the points and some of the responses I've had, you know, we need to do more. We need to outreach more. We need to get out there more. We're always about ourselves. But it's really interesting how Jesus comes across. Because when we stop for a moment and look at the Bible, Jesus really interestingly only has few platforms from which we hear from him directly speaking to us. You know, he does a sermon, a really long sermon called the Sermon on the Mount. He then spends a lot of time in discipleship, you know, giving little lessons around parables and things with the people around him. Then he has this one chapter of prayer in which the one time we actually hear him praying to his Father in fullness, he talks solely about us and about how we interact with each other. It's called the Great Unity Prayer, praying for us to be one as he and the Father are one. And then there's this big gap where Paul kind of expounds a lot on what Jesus wrote, addresses a lot of the issues going on, and we don't really hear till Jesus until now in the book of Revelation. And here again, he has a platform. And that platform is really interesting because never once to the seven churches does he challenge them about getting out into the community, about outreach, about evangelism. You'd think when he's got that platform, this should be important. Yet, he's actually focusing on the church, to each and every individual in that community. He never talks about the Romans. Never talks about the socio-political situation in the world at the time. He addresses the church. And he talks about our behaviors, how we interact with one another, and how we interact with him. So when someone tells me we need to be more out there, I'm going to push back on that. Because the Jesus I know challenges his church. And you know, when you change inside, and when we change here, that reflects when we leave. If I have to teach you to be outreaching, there's something wrong inwardly. There's something wrong inside of you. I can't change and force you to go out and outreach. I've brought a cinema in. I figured that might be easier for you all. We can't go out, we'll bring them in. But this is a challenge that we're faced with. That when Jesus has his platform to talk to us, he's talking directly about us. And so you need to understand, as God's church, it is all about us. For the world will know. You know how they will know? By our love for each other. And by our love for him. That's the biggest challenge. And so that's why Jesus spends so much time in these seven letters challenging the church, us, directly. He's challenging the mess that's inside of us, the brokenness that's there, because he reckons if we can get that right, then who you're going to be out in the world is just going to be you. Today we're into our fourth church, I think it is. Oh no, the third church, sorry. Pergamos or Pergamum, as it's known. And this is really interesting. We've seen the first two. Today, this is going to challenge us about what's going on inside us. Because this is actually very much straight to the heart. So just as an unusual Sunday, I will be challenging you this morning. And if you're ready for it, and you need a little bit of a stretch, do it now. And like I've done before, rub your temples if you need to. Give a pat to the person next to you and say, it's okay, we can get through this. Because we will, because we're here together through it. Okay, Pergamum. Pergamum's an interesting town. It's the capital of the region. It's got a great story. Aristophanes was the librarian at the great library of Alexandria. And Pergamum had its own great library. And so what they wanted to do is they wanted to poach the best librarian in the world, which happened to be this guy, Aristophanes, down in Alexandria. So they tried to poach him. But Ptolemy, who was the ruler of Egypt at the time, this is about 300 years before Christ was born, when Ptolemy found out that they were trying to poach his librarian, he had the librarian chained. That's called job security, by the way. He had him chained, and then he cut off Pergamum, because in Egypt, they developed a form of writing there. Does anyone know the material that they used to write on? Yes, papyrus. They used this form of writing. And so they said, we're going to stop shipment to Pergamum, who had this great library. So the Pergamums were like, oh, what do we do? How do we handle this? And so, the challenge was they're not going to have writing paper anymore. So they developed a new style of writing. They got animal skins, and I don't know what the process is, but out of Pergamum came parchment. It's a quite inventive place when they were forced to have to deal with an embargo because they wanted him to poach the librarian. But that said, around that time as well, a couple of hundred years later, they were so rich as a city that the king didn't want his sons to take over the city because he couldn't trust them. So he gave everything to Rome. And so that's one of the ways Rome got into this region. Pergamum, the king, basically bequeathed everything to Rome. This was the capital of the region. This is where the Lydians, who was a famous empire at the time, held themselves up in there. And Jesus opens up in his letter to the church with this. He says this, to the angel of the church in Pergamum write, these are the words of him who has the sharp, double-edged sword. Now remember from last week, every description means something particular to each church. Pergamum was the capital. The governor of the region, the Roman governor, held his seat there. He had what was known as the right of the sword. He was the one that made the call. All the judgments in the region. So for the people in Pergamum, they understood what Jesus is saying here. Last week, we saw that Smyrna was more like Tauranga. Week before that, Ephesus more like Auckland. Well, Pergamum's kind of like Wellington. I'm not up to how things work, but isn't the Chief Justice here in Wellington, or is it in Auckland? Because it's here, isn't it, right? Yeah, mostly it's in the capital generally. And so everything kind of comes out of here. Parliament's here. Everything's based here. The function of the country happens here. Just like in Pergamum, the function of the region happened in Pergamum. It's a great city. I've got a picture of it right there. Artist impression. It sprawled out over these hills. But like any capital city in the world, everything tends to congregate there. You know, here in Wellington, we've got all the embassies representing most of the countries in the world. They're all right here. But also every other organization that wants to lobby the politicians, they're based right here. You go to Washington, D.C., for example. Oh, my goodness. It's just everyone represents everything is found in D.C. It's the same with Pergamum. And Jesus writes this. He says this, I know where you live, where Satan has his throne, yet you remain true to my name. You did not renounce your faith in me, not even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was put to death in your city where Satan lives. So here are the Christians again living in the city where there is a lot going on. And the problem isn't so much just, you know, being persecuted for who they are. They were persecuted because they stood apart. This was a city of compromise. There was a lot going on in this place. There was a lot that offered good things that sounded very Christian-like. Well, sort of. Enough for you to compromise on. For example, the Temple of Dionysus. It was Dionysus, what they did here was he gave you assurance or security in the afterlife so that when you died, your spirit didn't go floating away somewhere. He would guide you in the right direction. Life after death. The thing is, to connect with Dionysus, you had to get yourself into a bit of a state. And the way they had this ritual of connecting with Dionysus was raw meat and lots of wine. So they'll gorge on raw meat, drink lots and lots of wine, run into the hills naked. The Romans banned the Temple of Dionysus in Rome because it was just too much for them. If it's too much for the Romans, you've got to understand that might be. It's extraordinary. But that's what they did. The Temple of Dionysus was based in the region in Pergamum. But the thing to hold on to is this, life after death. Another temple. Anyone know what that symbol represents today? Yes. I don't understand how there aren't any Pentecostals screaming that as medical professionals you come under a banner of a false god. But actually, that's where they get their thing. Temple of Asclepius was a healing place. He was the god of healing. And the way it worked with Asclepius was this very mystical place. You go in through a tunnel and you come out the other end and the doctors will examine you first. And like good healing ministries, they'll take you if they think they can heal you. And if you can't be healed, they must probably turn you away. Ooh, ouch. But yes, if you were pregnant, they wouldn't take you. And if you were dying, they wouldn't take you. But anything else, they'd take you in. And then they would put you in a chamber, most probably drug you, and allow you to sleep and listen to the voice of Asclepius. He'd come and tell them a treatment in the mind, and then the doctors would interpret that dream or that meaning, and then they'd prescribe some sort of ointment or prescription of healthy living. It used to have a lot to do with water, you know, having a bath of some sort, or going into a new diet, or refraining from alcohol and raw meat, you know, stuff like that. And what the patients would do as they left is that they would, on a white marble, mark out what their issues were, mark out their name, and give thanks to Asclepius. And we've got some of these remnants here. This guy had a problem with his ears. And here he names himself and he thanks Asclepius for healing his ears. There's other white stones that are found around where this temple was found. And along the road, as you go to the temple of Asclepius, you'd find all these white marble markers thanking the god Asclepius for their healing. Again, big deal. But that's not it. There was a temple of Demeter. Temple of Demeter was the temple where people came to be cleansed, to be forgiven. And part of the ritual was to be submerged in the blood of bulls. Yeah, I mean, they're really weird back then, weren't they, huh? Imagine in a white toga. Oh, man, I'm going to have to wash this now. You know, all these rituals sound very foreign to us. Very foreign. But that was what they did. They would go to the Temple of Demeter. And the people of Pergamum, I guess they compromised so much that just to make sure that they hadn't done anything wrong or hadn't followed anything, they'd go to the temple there, they would be immersed in the blood of bulls, they would have to fast for a day, and then they would be cleansed of whatever guilt that they might have felt or sin that they had. And then lastly, the temple of Serapis, who was a Greek god. And this is actually known as the Red Basilica because the Christians took over this centuries later. But this has a checkered history. The building was originally dedicated to the god of Egypt, the god Serapis. But then the Pergamums wanted to honor Rome, and so they dedicated it to the god who was Julius Caesar, who then became Caesar Augustus. And then later on, it became to Hadrian. And then later on, the Christians took over this building and it went to the God Almighty. But you get this picture here of here is the temple of God. It doesn't matter how you want to name him. Just go there and worship him. And that's literally what the Pergamese did. In fact, they found so many different types of God ruins in this place that they kind of lost track of who was this for? The one that stood out was Serapis. So they thought, okay, this is just a temple to the God, whoever it is that you worship. And then Jesus goes on and he says this, "Nevertheless, I have a few things against you, to you guys in Pergamum as a church. There are some among you who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin so that they ate food, sacrificed to idols, raw meat, and committed sexual immorality, running in the hills. Likewise, you also have those who hold to the teaching of the Nicolaitans." And the Nicolaitans were these guys, these Christians, who were trying to just fit in with what was going on around them. You know, let's just not cause too much trouble, guys, because then a lot of attention comes onto us. Let's just do what everyone else is doing. It's just God. God's still God. "Repent, therefore, otherwise I will soon come to you and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth." He's not talking about them as in the Romans or anyone else. He's talking about us. Jesus has pretty harsh words to say to his people. Really harsh words to say to his people. "I've got another drummer." What is it about cymbals and drums that attracts children? They're loud and fun, exactly. It's interesting when you read about Jesus in the Bible, who does he have the biggest beef with? Hypocrites? No. Who are the people? The Pharisees. Why? Well, the hypocrites. Because they should know better. They're the ones that have memorized God's law. They're the ones that know God. They should know better. And yet with the people around him, the people who don't know God, the people who have sinned, the ones on the outside, he has a remarkable amount of grace for. An incredible amount of patience and grace for those who don't know better. But for those on the inside, I think it's a little bit harsher. We flip it over, don't we? We're really harsh on those on the outside, while inside we just do anything. I was having a great conversation with a friend of mine this week who was like, "But Rob, Paul says homosexuality is wrong." And I said, "Have you read the next word? What does it say?" It says false witness, slander, gossip. Why aren't you as harsh on those? Because on inside the church, we're okay with all of that. But outside the church, oh my goodness, that's just wrong. We're really picky about pointing out. But here Jesus is pointing and saying, you guys should know better. And here he's challenging them. There's a lot in this place, a lot that's going on in Pergamum that can distract the church in ways that's really challenging. I mean, think about it. The Temple of Dionysus has this option of life after death. That sounds Christian. That's close. I mean, okay, it's just a bit of meat and we just run around in the hills. We're not hurting anybody. Well, you're hurting me. I see you naked. But it's close. You know, they're fellowshipping. I don't know how to make it sound good, but it's not. It's life after death. They're trying to make it sound right. But how about the Temple of Asclepius? There's healing there. If you've got a problem, God can do it too. He can speak through that. Can't he? Come on, look, there's healing there. This is Christian. Well, what about the Temple of Demeter? Forgiveness. It's like baptism, but it's just blood. Water, blood, you know. Water's 90%, I mean, blood's 90% water, isn't it? You can see how they're trying to compromise. What about the Temple of Serapis? Oh, it's God. It's all God. It's all the same. You can hear how this church is being pulled in different directions. Is it this? Is it that? Is it that? Is it this? And Jesus is challenging them and saying, hey, kind of like the same challenge we face today, but not as straightforward as back then. Today, it's a lot more subtle. You see, what we value will ultimately determine how we live and what we do. And this is what the Pergamese are stuck with. What they value will determine how they live. And what, if I want to fit in, then I'll do everything I can to fit in. In fact, we do that in church as well. We try to fit in. Everyone looks great here. Everyone's happy. So I'll fit in. And then they become the values by which we live by. Some of you here are Christian. You're challenged by Christ and want to be a Christ follower. You don't get it right all the time, but that's not the point. You do what you can to follow Christ. Some of you here are not Christian. You thought you're coming to a buffet breakfast this morning. And you're like, where's the bacon? I don't see any bacon in here. What's going on? Some friend of yours might have invited you here and you're thinking, what am I stuck in? That whole singing thing was weird. Now this guy's up here talking about stuff. That's weird. That's okay. The biggest challenge is actually for those of you who think you are Christian, who have lived this life of Christian. The problem is, most people who say they're Christians are the ones who are challenged, am I really a Christian? Whereas those who think they are a Christian really think they are Christian and aren't challenged by who they are. And that's the challenge we face. Salvation is the work that we can't do. Jesus does it for us. I call that God awareness. I am aware of God thanks to the work of Jesus Christ and only through Jesus Christ. The resurrection is reconciliation. I call that self-awareness, where Jesus points at me and says, where are you at? A lot of us have this God awareness, but we're really missing this self-awareness of what's going on inside of me. Am I being challenged in my walk? Am I truly following Christ, or am I following something that someone's told me to do and this is how I do it? Matthew 7:21 has this verse, and I've used it a few times, but it really speaks to the heart of this. Didn't we do this in your name, Lord? Didn't we do that in your name? Didn't we do this? Miracles and prophesying and all these things. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles. And then I'll tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. How does that work? How does that even work? in Ephesus. They were challenged. They were challenged by this idea of right theology versus love. Legalism and love. They erred on the side of right theology and they got it wrong. In Smyrna, they were challenged by this life. That went too fast. Let's try that again. This life versus the afterlife. The difficulty of being faced with this idea that God tells them, look, you're going to have to suffer for a little while and some of you will die. Oh, what a life to look forward to. Woohoo! You know, forget about prosperity. That's out the window. I'm not going to get that car I want. I'm not going to be blessed. I'm going to die. And the idea there is actually really in your face. It's not about this life. It's about the afterlife. And in Pergamum, it was this. What you say versus what you do. I can't teach you to evangelize. You know, the whole three-point plan of what you need to do, that's consumerism. Okay? That's the world telling you to come up with a great marketing strategy. There is nothing great about trying to market a man on a cross. You can't paint that pretty in any sort of way or convince people that they're sinners. Try to convince yourself that you're a sinner. How does that work? It's by who you are. It's by the love that we share for one another. It's by how we interact. The world sees right through us. They see right through us. Why do you think some of our young people want to deconstruct their faith today? Because they've just looked at the church and they thought, what is going on there? Why in New Zealand, in 2001, 58% of the population said they were Christian. Today it's 37%. Why is it today that 49% of New Zealand's population says they have no religious affiliation? And I'd imagine there will be some people in that no religious affiliation place who would say they would actually believe in God. They just don't understand Christendom or church because they've either been hurt, ostracized, seen the hypocrisy, hearing what we say but not seeing what we do. In Titus it says this, they claim to know God but by their actions they deny him. They are detestable, disobedient, and unfit for doing anything good. Those are harsh words. They're really harsh words. I think Paul just had a bad day that day, but I know how it feels sometimes. We're challenged as a church to not think of what we can do. I can give you every great program. I've gone through all sorts of things. I can't even begin to tell you. We started with the purpose-driven church. What was that, 30 years ago now? 25 years ago? And we've gone through the emerging church. We've gone through all sorts of things of trying to rehash and remake church. And all it comes down to is just us loving one another. Simple. But yet so simple. Spouses have a hard time loving each other. Imagine what a church is going to look like. That's why I got to work at it. Work at what's going on inside of us. Become a little bit more self-aware. I did say I was going to challenge you this morning. What we value will ultimately determine how we live and what we do. If we want to criticize church and criticize the pastor and criticize what's done and not done and sit there and not do anything about it, guess what we're going to look like? If we just sit down and try to make program after program and try to do this and try to do that, guess what's going to come out of that? Guess what that's going to look like? If we're intentional of loving one another wherever we're at, whatever it is that we might even believe. Tonight we're showing another documentary, which I'm sure is going to have a lot of people uncomfortable on hell. But I just want to remind you about this. Whether you believe in hell or not, doesn't save you. Jesus does. Right theology doesn't save you. Jesus does. So just keep an open mind. What we value will ultimately determine how we live and what we do. And then Jesus does this interesting thing in how he concludes this church. He says this, whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who is victorious, I'll give some of the hidden manna. The hidden manna was what Asclepius would give to those patients, that drug that will knock them out so they get those dreams. He's actually changing it around. He's using a word that the Jews themselves would understand. I'm going to give you something that's not what they give you. I'll give it to you. And not only that, I'll give that person a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to the one who receives it. And in that town, white stones had a meaning. It had a meaning for them. So what do we take away this morning? What do we hold on to now and walk out with rather than feeling like, ugh? The challenge is not difficult. It might be difficult to live out. But the challenge is, if we're going to be his church, there's going to be a lot that's going to vie for our attention. In this world, our jobs tend to take away our time from church. Time from fellowshipping or hanging out or being together or reading our Bibles. TV does that. I've discovered Xbox. I'm a little late on the scene. I know. I've been using my iPad all this time. I've not used the iPad in a week now. Why? When I've got Xbox. There's a lot of things that take our attention away from God. There's a lot of things. That's why we have to be intentional. If you're not part of a life group, you need to get involved in a life group, because there is intentionality there. It's a small group of people who will love you and care for you, and if they don't love you and care for you, let me know, and I'll go deal with them. Okay? That was an uncomfortable laugh, wasn't it? A big Italian bloke coming in with his mates. No, it won't be like that. But that's the place where you get it. On Sunday mornings is the time we come together and we worship God and we re-challenge to get back out there and do what God's called us to do. It's not about what we like, whether it's the songs or the preaching or someone said something I didn't like. Because it's not about us, even though it is. That's the challenge we got this week. Call to a life group. Hook into one. And your life group might be your quilting group. Your life group might be the coffee that you have on a Saturday morning with a bunch of mates. That's fellowship. That's connecting. Are you connecting? And how is that self-awareness working? How's the mirror to your own soul look like? Does that challenge you? Because God is wholly focused on his people to be the people he's called us to be. And the light on a hill shines naturally. The ones that are unnatural can turn on and off. The natural ones stay on all the time. If we're to be a light on a hill in Lower Hutt, it's got to come naturally to us. Loving one another and loving our God. I don't know if that's enough of a challenge for you, but I can give more if you want. Amen? Amen. Amen. Stop, please, Rob, stop. I've had enough. Ask the worship team to come up. Let's just take a moment as they lead us in song and worship. Just take a moment to maybe think about yourself. Maybe you're the one that's kind of pushing that we need to do more as a church. Or maybe something needs to change in you. Something needs to change in you. So I want you to take this moment as they sing, just to kind of self-reflect. Lift yourself up to the Lord and say, Lord, here I am. What am I to do? What can I do to build this fellowship up? Not by just doing, but by being.